Support for TPR comes from UT San Antonio, offering degree programs and research focused on workforce development, student success, and health innovation across Texas. UTSA.edu. UT San Antonio, the University of Ambition.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Be careful where you step when you're heading outside this summer because there be snakes. Texas is home to rattlesnakes and other poisonous pit vipers. The good news is death from a snake bite is not that common. Nevertheless, we're going to be talking about what to do and what not to do if you come across a snake and if you happen to get bit. Rising summer temperatures mean more Texans are spending time outdoors, and they are more likely to encounter venomous snakes in the parks, the wooded areas, along waterways, and even in your own backyard. We're joined by Dr. Stephen Alex Harding, a Baylor College of Medicine toxicologist and also an emergency room physician. And Dr. Alex, welcome to The Source.
Hey, Dave. Thanks for having me.
So, as I understand it, roughly 7,000 to 8,000 people are bitten by a venomous snake annually here in the U.S., but only about 5 die a year. So I think it's really important before we start scaring people about snakes and things that we actually kind of put that in context. If you get bitten by a snake, that's not necessarily a death sentence.
Absolutely. Yeah. The deaths are pretty rare. Most of what we focus on with our management is preventing kind of morbidity. So preventing people from losing function of limbs, things like that. But as you mentioned, deaths are much more common based off of kind of the type of snake. And luckily we don't have that many of the real dangerous species. A lot of the rattlesnakes are a lot more dangerous than the copperheads and cottonmouths that are much more common in our area.
Right. So we have the rattlesnakes. That's the most widespread venomous snake in Texas. And it's a major source of a serious bite. So when I read about this to get ready for today, you know, I kept reading about how not all rattlesnake bites are venomous bites. That's the first thing to try to understand.
Well, one thing to recognize is that when you're bitten, the snake itself gets to decide kind of how much venom or if they're actually going to inject any venom into you. There's misconceptions about kind of the age of the snake. People often kind of misattribute more or less dangerous bites to juvenile snakes under the assumption that a younger snake might not be able to control how much venom they're delivering. Every snake is able to control kind of how much venom is delivered. So there is a concept of what's called a dry bite, where somebody gets tagged by a snake, but not necessarily envenomated. So it runs the gamut from, you know, full envenomation, every drop the snake has, all the way to no venom. And really, the physical examination and being evaluated by a physician is kind of the only way to know for sure.
Well, I wonder, what does it feel like? I mean, I'm sure if I get bit by a snake, it's going to hurt. But if I get bit by a snake and they inject venom into me, is it going to hurt more? Am I going to feel that?
Absolutely. Yeah, the initial bite could be probably compared to something like a bee sting or a wasp sting. That's literally just the penetration of the skin by the fangs. But once the venom is delivered, all the different components that are inside of there go to work in causing local tissue damage, swelling. So you get a lot of kind of the pressure of swelling in that extremity, along with this kind of spreading pain that then kind of creeps up the arm. And the extent of the involvement is kind of dependent on how much venom was delivered and then which species you were actually envenomated by.
So our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. If you've ever had a snake bite, if you want to tell us your story, you want to tell us what happened, we'd love to hear about that. Or if you've got a question about a snake bite. So people who are, you know, where you're most likely to be bit by a snake, these are places, you know, outdoors, typically, I would think, you know, but it's not impossible. I guess you could, you know, one can get in the house or in your wherever you are.
Probably a little bit less common, but yeah, it would depend kind of where you're at as far as proximity to a larger city versus, you know, woodlands and bayous and things like that. But for the most part, we're talking about wooded areas or bayous as places where you're more likely to get bitten. And then it also depends on what activities you're doing in those areas. There actually is sort of almost a gender split that we notice among envenomations, where women tend to get envenomated on the legs more often, whereas men tend to get bitten on the upper extremities, so the hands. And part of that, at least, is due to, men messing with snakes, trying to relocate them, trying to kill them, those types of activities.
So I'm always freaked out when I'm having to, like, mess around with the wood pile. It's like I'm afraid that they're going to be, maybe like Woody from Toy Story, there's a snake in my boot. I'm worried there's a snake in the wood pile.
Yeah, it's very possible. The nice part about it is that most snakes are not going to be aggressive and that they're not going to be hunting you. A lot of the envenomations that we see, probably the vast majority of them, are going to be defensive on the snake's part. So if you do notice that there's a snake or you're concerned that there's a snake, you can spray, that area with a water hose, for example. They tend not to like that, and then they oftentimes will slither away. But I would caution people against, just recklessly killing snakes as soon as they see them, because they are an important part of the ecosystem in managing other pests and things like that. If you do have pets or small children that you're concerned about getting, getting in contact with a snake, then you can also speak to local kind of wildlife rescue groups and have somebody come out and relocate the animal to somewhere a little bit less concerning for you.
I've heard that. If you kill a snake, you cut off its head or something with a shovel or what have you, and then that the head could still bite you.
And so, yeah, there was a case probably, I don't remember the exact date of the publication, it was probably about 15 years ago, where a gentleman had done just that. He had decapitated a snake and then came back a little while later to get rid of the parts. Grabbed the head, and it had enough kind of residual neurologic function that it doubled back and envenomated him. He called 911 appropriately in that case, and unfortunately, probably about an hour later, ended up going into cardiac arrest and dying. So kind of job number one is don't mess with the snake if you can.
Yeah, and don't think just because it's been decapitated that it is no longer a threat. You got to keep that in mind. And I guess also, so yeah. Don't leave it lying around where someone else can mess with it as well. So if you get bit by a rattlesnake, but we have the things like the cottonmouths and the water moccasins and the copperheads here. Is there any one that is more of a threat than the others?
I would be more concerned about the rattlesnakes compared to the copperheads and cottonmouths. For the most part, the trend that we see is that copperheads are kind of the most minor of the pit viper envenomations. The cottonmouths or water moccasins are right there kind of in the middle, and then the rattlesnakes are kind of the most severe. And that could be timber rattlesnakes, prairie rattlesnakes, eastern diamondbacks, western diamondbacks. There's even one in kind of the Mojave Desert region that in addition to having the tissue damage that you see with all of these pit vipers, it also has some neurologic complications, and it could cause paralysis and difficulty swallowing, double vision, things like that. So I would be most worried about somebody getting envenomated by a rattlesnake in terms of needing more aggressive therapy and potentially having more complications.
And then there are also coral snakes, and those are smaller snakes. And they have little tiny fangs, but they're just as dangerous?
They are dangerous in a different way. So the coral snakes are a member of the elapid family of snakes. So this is kind of a similar group as cobras, but luckily we don't have any native cobras in our area. Depending on where you're at in the country, coral snakes can be neurotoxic, so can cause those similar things like I was talking about with the Mojave rattlesnake, where you can develop muscle weakness, especially if that's your diaphragm, then you can lose your ability to breathe and need to have a breathing tube inserted. You can get double vision, you can get difficulty swallowing. But in certain areas, it seems that the snake venom characteristics are different. So, for example, I practice down in Houston, and in our area, most of the coral snakes end up just causing pain, whereas in other parts of the country, we would be worried about that paralysis type stuff.
Well, these are like the native snakes that we have that you're going to encounter outside. But a lot of people have pet exotic snakes. And so I'm sure like emergency rooms are prepared to deal with things like, you know, a rattlesnake bite, a coral snake bite, because these are more likely to happen. But if you get bit by your own exotic pet, would the emergency room be able to deal with the level of toxicity that you're going to get out of that?
Absolutely. I would anticipate that if that did happen, even if you went to your local emergency room, they could provide stabilizing care, but they would likely get in touch with at least the poison control centers and then be directed to a place that has more kind of robust framework for getting a hold of exotic antivenoms. We've certainly had cases where people were envenomated by their own pets and then flown to us down in the medical center. And we work very closely with the zoo where they keep kind of all of the exotic snake antivenoms in addition to the coral snake antivenom. So if they come in, we recognize that they would benefit from one of these antivenoms. We coordinate with their herpetology experts to figure out exactly which type of antivenom they need. And then in a very dramatic fashion, you know, drive up to the back of the zoo and somebody runs out with a cooler and hands it to us through the passenger side door. And then we come in kind of hero-like into the emergency department looking really cool.
I mean, I had wondered if there was any kind of coordination between the zoo and the ERs on stuff just like this. So, you painted a dramatic image there. So we're going to take a break here. We're going to talk more. So I want to get into what to do and what not to do if you do get bit by a snake. And these actions, though, they can save your life, but they could also save some of your limbs, save you from a lot of pain, and, you know, just figure out what to do. And we have Gil on the line. We're going to get Gil. He says that he wants to weigh in on this. He says he's a snake expert. And so if you got a question or a comment, call in 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. If you've ever been bitten by a snake, love to hear that story. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about snake bites. If you've often wondered if the Texas Public Radio is snake bit, well, I can tell you that we're talking about snake bites. And we're joined by Dr. Stephen Alex Harding. He is a Baylor College of Medicine toxicologist. He's also an emergency room physician. You can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And Gil, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. So first of all, I'm not a snake expert. I do have some academic background in it, but I wouldn't call myself an expert. Wanted to share some data points that I've observed in reading journals during my research and whatnot. So with kind of our listening audience, our listening area of, you know, Bear, Comal, Wilson, Atascosa, Medina, the surrounding counties, you know, we're talking about all these different venomous species of snakes. Just wanted to remind folks out there in this area that we only have 5 species of venomous snakes compared to 40 total snakes. So the odds of you encountering a venomous snake is already pretty slim. You're mostly going to encounter them along green belts or along peri-urban interfaces where you have development and then a wooded area for miles on end type of deal. And so those species that we have in this area are our western diamondback rattlesnake, which is by far our most common. Then we have our Texas coral snake. Then we have our second rattlesnake species, the black-tailed rattlesnake, which is confined to more rocky, hilly areas of the hill country. So think of like Government Canyon in San Antonio, that area, Helotes. And then finally, our copperhead, broad-banded copperhead, and our cottonmouth. And so it's just depending on where you are, what you may encounter. But for the most part, if you're going to find a snake in your backyard, it's going to be a non-venomous snake. So we have 40 species. That's a lot. I suggest you just familiarize yourself with the 5 that we have that could potentially be harmful and forget about everything else.
All right, Gil. You know, right. So anyways, and leave them alone. Just walk away. Thank you so much, Gil, for that. And so let's go to another caller. And the next caller is David. And David, you're on the air.
Hi, my name is David, and I worked at the Dallas Zoo in the largest rattlesnake collection in the world for 10 years in the 70s and 80s, and then I went to graduate school and studied rattlesnakes in Mexico and collected rattlesnakes in Mexico for my graduate degree. I've published on rattlesnakes. I have a tremendous amount of experience in all areas with rattlesnakes, and I wanted to make a couple of comments about rattlesnakes. One is that snakes in general, rattlesnakes in particular, usually know you're there. Rattlesnakes have a pretty good sense of hearing. They can hear spoken word. They have they don't hear as well as humans do or most mammals do, but they do hear the frequencies of talking. They also see pretty well, and they watch your face. When a rattlesnake becomes aware of your presence, and it's almost always before you're aware of their presence, a rattlesnake watches your face and judges your trajectory. And if he decides that your trajectory is going to take you over him, or he sees that you're looking at him, then that his nerve will break, he'll move, he may rattle, he may not rattle, they don't always rattle. But he bases it on how he interprets your actions, and usually before you even see. I mean, I'm an experienced rattlesnake guy, and I've walked within a foot of large rattlesnakes that were sitting in leaf litter, and they were perfectly camouflaged, and they didn't move a muscle because they thought, he's an idiot. He doesn't see me. He's walking right past me. It's like, you know, and the rattlesnake didn't move until I happened to turn around and look where I'd been, and then his nerve broke and they would break.
Right.
It happened more than once.
So, David, I'm going to let you go. Thank you for that great information. We've got to hit these high points here. What to do, what not to do if you get bit by a rattlesnake. Dr. Alex, I mean, one thing I read, this is circle it. If you get bad, circle your bite with a pen or something. Also, write down the time that you get bitten. Also, take off your rings. If your hand swells, your ring could be the problem. You don't want to lose the finger. What other big high points? And don't do the Lone Ranger Tonto routine by cutting open the wound and trying to spit out the venom. That doesn't work. It just causes more tissue damage.
Absolutely. There's a unified snake bite algorithm that was published back probably about a decade ago at this point, and it hits a lot of these high points as far as what not to do. And it's basically anything that you have seen in an old Western is something that we're not going to be doing. For the most part, in the United States, we're close enough to healthcare that somebody's not going to die within minutes. So the whole tourniqueting an extremity after you get bitten by a snake is not going to be helpful. The venom gets absorbed within several minutes, probably through the lymphatic system mainly. So any of those kind of methods of trying to remove the venom, whether that's cutting on the wound, sucking on the wound, there are several commercial devices that are suction devices that purportedly suck the venom out of those areas. None of those are going to be helpful. And the worst thing that you could do in terms of sucking on that wound is then introduce all of the bacteria that are inside of your mouth into that wound and cause a secondary bacterial infection, which then is one, challenging to manage with antibiotics, but two, it clouds the picture as far as what's actually due to the venom effect and what's due to this bacterial infection of the skin.
So real quickly, I read let your wound bleed, let it bleed, and so it could bleed out a little bit of the venom. Don't patch it up. Let it, and should you do that?
I don't think I would specifically say like more bleeding is better. Number one, I think the point you brought up was great, which is marking the wound site. Usually that's going to be done by EMS or in the emergency department by physicians and nurses. And that helps us get a sense over time of how the wound is progressing and how much venom effect we're really seeing, which helps trigger when we want to give anti-venom.
But get to an ER, get to the hospital, use your cell phone, go get to the ER right as possible, and they'll take care of you. You'll be fine. All right. I want to thank you, Dr. Stephen Alex Harding, Baylor College of Medicine, toxicologist, emergency room physician. Stay away from snakes. This is The Source.
My name is Jasmine Garst, and I'm an immigration correspondent for NPR. Covering immigration right now is extremely challenging. A lot of the people I'm interviewing are hiding because they're too afraid to go outdoors. Something that I have really tried to focus on in my work is the humanity and the nuance and complexity of every human being, whether that is a 12-year-old girl trying to live her life in Minneapolis or a farmer in Florida. I think that we're at an inflection point in which we're really questioning our identity as a country, what we're okay with and what we're not. And that's something that I think is going to be a really big story this year. Your donation supports journalism that gets to the heart of the story. Please give today, and thank you.
And you can give by giving us a call at 800-622-8977. Go to tpr.org or go through the TPR app. We're here to give you real reliable information and break through the clutter and also bust the myths. And so information is power, and information can save your life, just like we're talking about what to do if you get bit by a snake. And it's better to know these things before you get by a snake. You know, you're not going to find it out in this couple of minutes that you're dealing with all this. You want a trusted, reliable source of information to give you the real facts. And that's what we do here, not just about being bit by a snake, but also about what happens at City Hall, what is happening with the police department, what is happening at the schoolhouse. All of these things matter to you. And thank you for trusting Texas Public Radio to give you the right information, things that you can count on, things that can save your life. But now also we're asking you to help keep Texas Public Radio on the air. Your support today is supporting trusted local journalism. You can do it right now by calling 800-622-8977. Go online to tpr.org or use the TPR app. And with me in the studio to tell you more is Camille Phillips, our TPR education reporter.
Yes. Hello, everyone. You count on TPR to keep you informed about what's happening close to home and around the world. But behind every report are journalists, producers, travel equipment, and the resources needed to bring accurate information to you. After the loss of federal funding last year, TPR is fully community supported. During this summer fundraising drive, we're working to raise $250,000 to help replace those lost dollars. And every gift is matched dollar for dollar. We're here because we need to replace that money, right? And we've made some good progress. We have $155,000 and some change left to raise. Thanks to you, every person calling one at a time. I know that number can seem overwhelming, but this whole thing works because people who listen give what they can, and it doesn't have to be a lot. It can be $5 a month, $10 a month, a dollar a day. The amount you can afford to give varies, but it doesn't have to be a lot. That's the thing. When you're a community, we do it together. So give what you can. Call 800-622-8977. And like we said, every dollar is matched. So it's a really good time to give.
In-depth journalism does take time. It takes a lot of resources, and it takes a really highly trained, dedicated team of reporters and editors and producers. And starting this month, Texas Public Radio and the San Antonio Report, we're working together to strengthen local journalism. We're expanding reporting here locally, and we're serving our community in a lot of new ways. And because we're going to be stronger together, we're going to have the benefit of the economy of scale. We no longer have to have two newsrooms and two light bills and all these different things. We're all going to be working together in one facility. We're also going to be able to amplify each other's reporting. So when they have a great story, we're able to bring it on the air. When we have a great story, they're going to put it on their website. And we're going to really try to help each other out in all sorts of ways, share resources and sources and people know types of background. This is going to create a new thing for San Antonio, a really robust nonprofit newsroom to serve the local community. And if this excites you as much as it excites me, I'm hoping that you decide to support us. During our summer fundraising drive, we're asking for $250,000. This fund is going to help keep this newsroom going. Every gift is matched dollar for dollar. Support your trusted local journalism today. New and improved and bigger than ever here at Texas Public Radio. Go to tpr.org, go through the TPR app, or calling us online. Thank you.
Yeah, now that we're with Texas Public Radio, got to go. But thank you so much for your support.
Mm-hmm. Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.